The only purpose of this podcast is to educate and to inform. It is no substitute for professional advice by a lawyer. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute legal advice or a direct solicitation for services. Instead, we encourage you to discuss your options with attorneys who concentrate their practice in the area of law discussed in this podcast. Guests who may occasionally appear or speak in this podcast express their own opinions, experience, and conclusions, and neither Chacon Law Office nor any company endorses or opposes any particular opinion discussed in this podcast. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Advertising which is incorporated into, placed in association with, or targeted towards the content of this podcast is forbidden. You may not edit, modify, or redistribute this podcast.
Hello, I'm attorney Carlo Chacon. I'd like to provide some information related to some legal topics that I practice in personally here in the Northeast Ohio area. I'm a certified public accountant in the state of Pennsylvania, and I'm also a licensed attorney in the state of Ohio. The area of bankruptcy law, like any other body of law, it's complicated, ever-changing, requires the knowledge, experience, and competency found in attorneys who practice in this area. There's a tendency with today's society to seek self-help. You need an attorney to help you maneuver through all the thick and thin found in any body of law. There's been a tendency over the past years to provide avenues so that everyone has equal access to the legal system, and by doing so, it oftentimes leads to unintended consequences because of how people's opinions are formed when they're encouraged to go it alone, so to speak. When a client represents themselves without an attorney, they're known as a pro se party. And my personal experience and observation tells me that too many pro se parties have bad experiences by doing so, and they form their opinion about the legal system based on a few experiences in court because they went at it alone for the sole purpose of saving money. And like any endeavor, there's a cost-benefit analysis that you need to do so that the old adage seen on prior commercial decades ago of pay me now or pay me later doesn't come back to haunt you. When you're facing dire straits because of financial setbacks, see an attorney who specializes in that area of law. On average, the bankruptcy petition for a Chapter 7 is roughly 50 pages in length, and it's comprised of many summaries and schedules, informational documents. If they're not filled out correctly or vital information is omitted, you run a high risk of having your petition dismissed. And not only have you wasted the time and energy, but in the end, you'll either have decided not to refile when you should, or you start where you have to from the very beginning, and that's to seek the advice of an attorney anyway. I hope you find these podcasts informative. If you're an attorney and you know that I've said something in these podcasts that are incorrect, please bring them to my attention and email me at CICCONE@CARLOCICCONELAW.com. That's Chacon at CarloChaconLaw.com. I have three topics that I'd like to discuss in today's podcast. Topic one has to do with general documentation requirements in a bankruptcy that you should have available before you seek the advice of an attorney. Topic two addresses some of the more specific requirements and the reasons for them. In topic three, I'll discuss some of the pitfalls and misunderstandings that clients have addressed with me in the past. Topic four will address the simple requirement of the pre-petition credit counseling course and the post-petition financial management course and the timelines involved. These topics are meant to be brief, succinct, and clear. Topic 1 addresses general documentation requirements. I spoke to an attorney who's been practicing in the area of bankruptcy law for quite some time now, and he said to me that when he started, the petition was about 8 pages long. It's now about 50 on average. As a result, there's a lot more information an attorney needs prior to filing either a 7 or a 13 petition. And I want to note that there's other chapters as well, but for right now, I'm just going to concentrate on the 7 and the 13. I'll address the others in future podcasts, and I'll outline what those differences are. Anytime I receive a phone call from the potential client who's looking for a bankruptcy, I ask them to bring in several pieces of documentation. Number one is the last 3 years of federal and state income tax returns. Number two, at least 6 months' worth of pay stubs from their employer. Number three, at least 6 months worth of bank statements for all their bank accounts, regardless if they were open or closed in the last 6 months. And number four, their driver's license and social security card, so that I can verify that they are who they say they are. Also, I let them know to be prepared to sign a fee agreement at the first meeting, where I outline what services I'm going to provide and what the cost of those services are. By nature, there's more work involved in a Chapter 13 petition because a payment plan has to be submitted and eventually approved by the trustee, and consequentially, fees are higher for a Chapter 13 as a result. Just briefly, I'll tell you that the difference between a Chapter 7, which is commonly known as a liquidation, and a Chapter 13, which is basically a reorganization, is that a 13 requires a payment term of 3 years or 5 years, depending on several factors. In a 13, you need to make sure that your payments on secured loans are kept current and that you can also afford to make monthly payments to the trustee who's responsible for dispersing those payments among your unsecured creditors, like a credit card company. What's really important to understand is that if you're coming in to talk about repairing credit, bankruptcy is not going to do it initially. I tell potential clients all the time, you need to determine what you value most. Your credit rating is probably damaged anyway, so this notion of not ruining credit and at the same time filing for bankruptcy is nonsense. To qualify for a Chapter 7, your income, averaged over a 6-month period right before filing, has to be below certain income levels based on your household size. This is known as the means test. Now, each state develops their own income figures based on the population of their state and what the averages are in earnings for people in the same position as you regarding your household size. That's it in a nutshell. If you fall above the income level, you are not automatically disqualified, but rather, step two of the means test must be completed. If your disposable income after performing step two is still above that magic number, you won't qualify for a 7. Your only option may be a Chapter 13. There are other reasons why a 7 may not be good for you, but I'll get to that in later podcasts. Topic 2 deals with more specific requirements. I practice in the Northern District of Ohio, and after I file a petition, I have 7 days before the 341 creditors meeting to make sure that your tax returns for the prior tax year are in the hands of the trustee. If you haven't filed taxes in the past, you need to get those done first. There's no getting around this. I know for a fact that if you haven't filed taxes from over 3 years ago and you're entitled to a refund for those tax years, you're not getting your refund. The statute of limitations is 3 years for your refund. If you filed all your previous taxes but you've lost your copies of your tax returns, I always have people fill out IRS Form 4506-T, which allows the IRS to forward tax transcripts to me directly, which I then provide to the trustee. Usually I'll get the tax transcripts between 10 to 20 days after I've faxed the request to the IRS. In today's economy, having a series of pay stubs over the last 6 months is a blessing. If you're one of the fortunate people to have been working consistently over the last 6 months and paid by a reputable employer consistently over those last 6 months, bring in those pay stubs. Or get a printout from your human resources department that shows what you've made for the last 6 months at least. Your human resources department is probably using payroll software that can generate these kinds of reports. So even if you've lost your pay stubs, maybe you can get it from your human resources department. Some systems allow you to even get online and print your pay stubs. The reason 6 months are required is that an accurate means test calculation can be performed. In addition, the last 2 months of pay stubs are to be copied and scanned by your attorney and forwarded as part of the petition when it's filed. If you've not worked or you don't have pay stubs, you need to bring in other documentation showing what your income was for the last 6 month period. For example, if you're a Social Security disability recipient, the Social Security Administration provides you with an annual letter every January listing the amount of monthly benefits you're going to be receiving that year. Bring that in. If you own a business and you use any kind of accounting software, print out a balance sheet, an income statement, and if your software does provide it, a statement of cash flows. The balance sheet and the statement of cash flow is as of a certain date and time. The income statement is rather for a series of times, such as a 6 month period, a 9 month period, or obviously 1 year. Bring in an income statement that has at least 6 months of activity. If you don't have pay stubs, at least in the Northern District of Ohio, I'm required to have an affidavit signed by you that states that you don't have pay stubs for the last 60 days. Bring in each and every bank statement that you have for the last 6 months on every account you have, even if you've closed it in the last 6 months. There's due diligence that an attorney needs to perform prior to filing your petition. Part of that due diligence is to make sure that some transactions aren't red flags, because if they are, you may be unable to file. If you do, your petition may eventually be dismissed if there's any activity that's considered fraudulent or intentionally and willfully performed just to hide assets in anticipation of filing a bankruptcy. It's important to understand that you may have to wait a certain period of time before you file if you've actually transferred assets within a certain time frame in the past, even though it was done for the right reasons. For the purposes of the 341 creditors meeting, the trustee is required to verify your identity and is required to view a valid driver's license and Social Security card. If you've lost your Social Security card, the best thing to do is to go to the administration building in your local area and get one as soon as possible. Creditors meetings are usually scheduled anywhere from 45 to 60 days after the petition is filed, so make sure you have what you need for the creditors meeting. You run the risk of having the meeting continued for a two-week period by not having the proper identification. Topic 3. Pitfalls and misunderstandings. There are several areas in bankruptcy that seem to trip up people. I just want to briefly discuss them. I've had questions posed to me in terms of what debts can be included in the petition and what assets need to be included. Everything gets included. If you're not open with your attorney in terms of what you own or what you owe, and that's later found out, you're going to have a lot of unhappy people on your hands, including your attorney. One of the questions you're asked at the creditor's meeting is whether you had the opportunity to review your petition prior to it being filed. That also means that you reviewed all the schedules and that they're complete and accurate. You sign off on these documents as well. In the eyes of the court and the trustee, there's no excuse for those schedules to be incomplete. The trustee has the power to move the court to dismiss your case as a result. Bankruptcy law provides the ability to keep assets that fall under an exemption amount for that particular asset. For example, if you own your home, at least in Ohio, in November of 2011, when I'm recording this, the exemption is $21,650 if you're filing a petition individually. It's double that amount if it's a joint petition. Here's what that means. If your house is valued at $50,000 and you have a $30,000 mortgage, you have equity of $20,000. The entire $20,000 is exempt because it obviously falls under that exemption amount. This is a very simplified example, and I'm not going to get into the details now. That'll be for a later podcast. Ohio is one of those states that lets debtors in Ohio use state exemptions as opposed to federal exemptions. What this comes down to is this. You may have to make some tough decisions, and you have to weigh those decisions against the benefits you'll receive after your debts are discharged. The other area of concern I have is the timing of your petition. If you file a petition while you have an outstanding tax refund coming your way, the trustee's entitled to it, whether it's in whole or a portion of it. Once you file a bankruptcy, you create a bankruptcy estate, and it's up to the trustee to determine what unexempt assets can be used to pay creditors. Topic 4. Certifications. Before you can file a bankruptcy petition, whether it's a 7 or a 13, you have to complete a pre-petition credit counseling course. There's a certificate that's forwarded to either you or your attorney, and that certificate has to be scanned and filed with the petition. There are some exceptions where the course may not be required, or you may be able to file it within a reasonable amount of time after the petition is filed, but as a general rule, I won't file a petition without the certificate. After the petition's filed, the client's required to complete a financial management course where a certificate is also issued and registered with the court by your attorney. The deadline to have this petition filed with the court is 60 calendar days after the 341 creditors meeting. But here's the confusion. Understand that you don't have to wait until the creditors meeting to complete the course. The only reason the creditors meeting comes into play is to trigger the deadline, and don't wait until the last minute. That completes this podcast on general and specific documentation requirements, the pitfalls and misunderstandings, and the pre- and post-petition counseling and financial management course. This is not all-inclusive by any means, and I encourage anyone listening to this podcast that if they have additional questions, consult a local attorney. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you find these podcasts enjoyable. If you have ideas for future podcasts related to either bankruptcy, IRS issues, tax preparation, or tax litigation with the IRS, please email me at Ciccone@CarloCicconeLaw.com. CICCONE@CarloCiconeLaw.com. That's Ciccone@CarloCicconeLaw.com. Thanks for listening.